welcome to this episode of Inside Briefing, the podcast from the Institute for Government. I'm Emma Norris, IFG's Deputy Director and today's podcast presenter. It's been quite some week for the Home Secretary and for the Home Office. A row over her speeding fine saw Suella Braverman appear on front pages. Today's release of net migration stats means she's going to be making headlines for the next few days too. And all of this follows her surprisingly free-ranging speech at last week's National Conservatism Conference. The Prime Minister has stuck by her, but is Braverman actually doing a good job or showing the loyalty that Rishi Sunak might expect? We'll take a look at a question which is rumbling away beneath a lot of the controversy around the Home Secretary too, and that's the impartiality of the civil service. Some government ministers want to see more political appointments to top Whitehall jobs. Well, this week the IFG set out our view, and we'll take a look at what on earth is going on between the Cabinet Office and the COVID inquiry. And with perfect timing, we've got a new IFG report out, which examines the cultural and institutional problems that run deep in the Home Office. We'll be talking to its author. So we've got a lot to get through. I'm joined by a pair of IFG colleagues who were into the ministerial code before it became cool. Kath Haddon and Tim Durrant. Hi, guys. Hello. And I'm delighted to be joined by Harry York, Deputy Political Editor at the Sunday Times and the journalist who broke the Braverman story this week. Harry, thanks for joining us.
No problem.
So let's kick off with Braverman. What's it like to get hold of a scoop like that, Harry, and then release it to the world?
I came into kind of possession of a tip about 3 or 4 weeks ago about the Home Secretary and a speeding fine last summer when she was Attorney General. And then I heard a little bit about a speed awareness course that was thrown into the mix. And it was quite cryptic. And I didn't really know what to make of it then. And so I spent the next few weeks making calls to various people. And the story started to kind of build. I started to build the picture. And by the end of it, the end of last week, we had a story that we at Sunday Times found to be quite eyebrow-raising. It looked as though the Home Secretary had asked her civil servants to try and get her a one-to-one private course, and that immediately raised a number of issues to do with the ministerial code. It was a rather tortuous 24 hours before publication because, as you might expect, and as you've seen post-publication, let's just say that sources close to the Home Secretary were not entirely forthcoming when we put the story to them. So it took repeated efforts before we finally got there.
I bet it did. And as you say, it's definitely been eyebrow raising. So what do you make of how Braverman has responded, how she's handled the story?
Well, I think compared to previous regimes, if we look at Boris Johnson's regime, which was to turn the royal slogan on its head, never complain, never explain. With Boris Johnson, it was complain a lot and never explain. She seems to have learned a lesson from that, because if you look at the exchange of letters between her and the Prime Minister yesterday, she basically gives a very detailed account of her side of the story, what she says happened. Now, I have to say, they didn't deny a single detail of the story that we wrote. They still haven't, and she hasn't denied any of it in the House of Commons in Parliament. She does, however, provide a slightly different version of events in her exchange of letters with the Prime Minister, but she expresses a kind of profound regret for how this appeared to people on the outside. So I think she's handled it well, because the Prime Minister took 2 to 3 days to determine what he was going to do. And I can say with authority that in the top levels of government over that 48-hour period, there was a real discussion about whether she had committed a serious breach. In fact, I can give you a bit of an exclusive today. My understanding was that up until the news about Boris Johnson's referral to the police dropping, it seems like they were set to refer her to the independent advisor. And then, lo and behold, the Boris Johnson story dropped. Lots of Tory MPs started threatening all kinds of things about the Prime Minister. And then the next morning, the Prime Minister decided not to refer the matter to the independent advisor. Now, it could be, of course, that between the Boris Johnson Ferrari landing in the papers and the morning after when the Prime Minister's making a final decision, it could have been, of course, that him and the Home Secretary had sat down and he was satisfied that she'd shown by issuing this apology. That may have been enough. Now, that could have changed his calculation, but all I'm saying is that effectively, as of Tuesday, it was my very clear understanding that they were very seriously considering a referral, and by Wednesday morning, they had decided not to. To go back to your original point, I think she's handled it better than some of her predecessors have.
Very interesting. So they were set to refer to the independent advisor. You heard it here on Inside Briefing first. Tim, what do you make of that?
It's interesting, right? Because like Harry said, you know, Sunak has taken a very different approach to ministerial code allegations in general. So we saw with Johnson, he would just tend to shut the matter down. So when the Hancock affair first broke, Johnson said, the Secretary of State has apologised, I consider the matter closed, that's it, there's no need for anything further. And obviously that's not how it panned out. With Liz Truss, she took it all very much, I mean, she was only there for a few weeks, but she took it all very much on herself. She was like, okay, if there's any allegations, I will fire this minister or I will ask this person to go. She was sort of very, jumped straight into action. Sunak has tended to be kind of his own approach and ask the advisor to do investigations. He asked Laurie Magnus to look into Nadeem Zahawi's tax affairs. He asked Adam Tolley to look into the allegations of bullying against Dominic Raab. So the fact that they were seriously considering this absolutely kind of plays into the way he has approached these kind of things throughout his premiership. And I mean, it's just what a week, right? It's fascinating that potentially one senior minister being investigated for the ministerial code is blown out of the water by a former prime minister being investigated by the police again.
Do you think that Sunak made the right call, Kath?
Yeah, I mean, probably in the end, because we were toying around with this since the weekend when, you know, the story first came out, that ministers do need to be able to ask, is it okay if I do something? You know, the ministerial code is there as, yes, a guide of what you can and can't do, but it is also a guide. It is advice. And sometimes things need exploring. And also, you know, talking to former civil servants who used to deal with this sort of stuff, you can imagine a minister thinking, look, this will have consequences for the government also. What should I do here? What's the best course of action? Obviously, that's the very optimistic view of it. The more cynical one is that if she didn't tell people about this in the Attorney General's office when she first got it, that's a problem. If she didn't tell the Cabinet Office about it when she was first appointed as Home Secretary, that's a problem. For me, the biggest problem, though, were the denials to the Mirror, what was 7 weeks ago, when they had the inklings of the story, as you put it. And if you are getting a special advisor to outright deny things to the press, that is clearly against the SPADS code, the Civil Service code, ministerial code. That those are things that you can't do. And that, for me, was the most serious issue in all of this.
And still hasn't been answered.
And
I should actually just add at this point that I would say that the issue about her special advisor at this moment in time, as of today, is not resolved. So it was interesting that in the exchange of letters, there was no mention of that issue. Mm. And that's because, as far as I understand, the issue is still pending.
Yeah.
And just to kind of come back on your points, I don't necessarily disagree with anything that you've just said about whether he made the right call here, because it's not my position as a reporter to say what the sanction should be. How could I possibly know? But all I would say on this is there is an issue about whether the civil servants felt they were being pressured, and the fact that they felt they needed to go to the propriety and ethics team for effectively institutional backup rather suggests to me that they did. And the other issue is, as you said, did she notify the Cabinet Office? Well, she didn't, and she admits as much in her letter. But what she says is that I didn't realise at the time I needed to notify, and I'm very grateful that after this saga happened, they changed the rules to make clear that everybody now needs to notify if you get a fixed penalty notice, which happened in November, which was several weeks after this just so happened to have occurred.
Tim, you wrote for us earlier this week that there's a risk that people are getting a bit carried away by the ministerial code. Can you tell us what you meant by that?
Look, obviously, I'm not going to say on Inside Briefing that ministerial standards aren't important. I think they are, and I think the ministerial code is a flawed but necessary document in our kind of political system. But what I meant was, I think there is a temptation to kind of try and turn every issue into a resigning matter. And this isn't just on the part of the media. I'm thinking particularly the opposition. You know, there were lots of Labour MPs. Yvette Cooper was very critical. Angela Rayner was very critical of Suella Braverman. And actually, I think that it risks the sort of debate and nuance just disappears, because people are like, either they broke the code and therefore they must go, or they didn't. And obviously there is a whole host of grey areas between those two positions. But also it means that the ministerial code and what a minister did or didn't do and did or didn't say becomes the only area of debate and story, when actually Suella Braverman is running one of the most important departments in government, and that department is facing a whole host of issues right now that it is not doing well at. I think, maybe this is naive, but I think we would be better served by a political debate that looked at those issues rather than just the sugar rush of, oh my God, is she going to go? Are we going to get another resignation? I know it's ironic because the Institute for Government gets excited about ministerial resignations, but there should be more to our debate. And I think, you know, the problem of the last few years is that it's been standards and resignations and scandal that has dominated rather than the content of government.
And also, I mean, from Labour's point of view, if they do end up in government sometime in the next couple of years, they're going to really rue the idea that everything that possibly breaks the ministerial code needs to lead to a resignation. Yeah. Especially if you're a new minister and you've not been in government before, you're going to get things wrong.
Yeah.
You're going to make mistakes where you want the opportunity to just apologise, hold your hands up. You know, we need to get back to a position where our politicians are being honest that when they have just made a mistake, that's what it was. I think the problem is that we've been so cultured by the Boris Johnson years where you just don't believe that it was a sort of open and honest mistake. Mm. And that's why we've ended up in the position we're at now.
There is also a point, though, to this, which they make it so much worse in every incident that we've kind of covered over the last 6 months of ministerial resignation. The journalist approach to this is it's always a cover-up that makes it that much worse. So I take on board what you're saying, but I think actually, because I know there's been a lot of people saying, oh, well, I wish the media would just focus on Ukraine and global affairs rather than asking the Prime Minister at the G7 about Suella Braverman's speeding fine. But the point is this, as journalists, if you feel that a minister has not only maybe committed a breach of the ministerial code, but then tried to avoid public scrutiny, we are duty bound to expose that. The distraction, I think, is actually the ministers themselves. You know, if they don't want the media to be distracted by these stories, then don't do them. I take on board what you're saying, that the ministerial code is such that there will be minor breaches. But if it's a minor breach, you know, if Suella Braverman had just been open and said, look, I got a speeding fine in June last year. I tried to do a speed awareness course, didn't work. I can tell you now that wouldn't be on the front pages of any newspaper.
No, and it's counterproductive from their part because, A, there is public interest in knowing that the Home Secretary has got a fixed penalty notice. And secondly, you know, there's some people been arguing it could have been a good comms opportunity to say no one is above the law. You know, there are totally different ways of doing it. If you are doing everything that anything that reveals something I've done wrong must be sort of hidden away from sight, you are in the wrong position. And the other side of it, though, we will come on to discussing a bit more, I'm sure, in a bit, is equally bad, which is those sort of saying, oh, this is a witch hunt. I mean, the way you've just set out how the story broke just shows this was not some civil service just fed this to the media because she'd done that speech at the NatCon conference. This was something that you had to chase down. This is not a conspiracy against Brexit politicians. It's just a case of if you do something wrong, there's a chance you'll get caught.
I can't tell you how frustrating that narrative is as a journalist who has spent a very, very long time and missed quite a few social events so that they could dedicate the time to pursuing a story. I saw somebody on GB News the other day suggest that basically civil servants just pick up the phone to people like me and just give you everything. And then, you know, it's just a case of putting it all to... And A, I'm not going to comment where the story came from. I can't say either way because it would just narrow down potentially where I got the tip. But what I will say is the idea that you've got civil servants on a hotline is just for the birds. It's just a nonsense. I think it is a deliberate attempt, actually, and I have to be a bit critical here of my profession, it is lazy to suggest that this is all just some sort of coordinated conspiracy against ministers. As you say, it doesn't work that way. And I think people should wise up to that fact.
And Kath, you mentioned the NatCon conference speech, and you've been thinking a bit about collective responsibility. I mean, did Braverman cross a line with the kind of speech she gave there?
Well, yeah, absolutely. If you're reading the sort of purist notion of collective responsibility, you are signed up to the government's policy. And until that policy is sort of designed, you don't go out making up your own policy. You can't be a backbencher and a minister at the same time. That said, the collective responsibility convention is both a convention and also quite a movable feast. It's something that prime ministers can use if they are strong to pull their ministers back into line. If they are weak, it is a way of sort of loosening the reins a bit. And you saw this throughout Theresa May's premiership. Boris Johnson was writing all kinds of articles setting out Brexit policy, writing newspaper articles and so forth with no consequences. Chequers, in effect, was collective responsibility. The Chequers deal was collective responsibility snapping back into place of, okay, well, this is now the line and you're either in or you're out. I think the question is for Sunak, at some point, is there going to be enough of a breach between him and Braverman on policy that he feels that she's got to go. On the other hand, there might be a point where she wants to go because she wants to be more vocal in her positioning on policy.
I think that's exactly the question, isn't it? I mean, Harry, what do you make of that? Do you think she wants to get sacked?
Well, a sketch writer, John Crace, a brilliant sketch writer at The Guardian, remarked after she stayed yesterday, he said, Suella Braverman survives to resign another day. And look, it's not for me to say what she may end up doing. I think, as you said, Kath, there is clearly a tension in government about where we're heading on how to control net migration and overall the immigration policy. You've got a Home Secretary who seems isolated among cabinet colleagues. She wants to not only get to grips with the small boats issue, where cabinet is aligned, and her ministers in the Home Office are aligned with her on that. Prime Minister definitely is. But when it comes to economic legal migration, there are massive fissures running through that cabinet. Jeremy Hunt and the Treasury will not consent to some of the measures that she wants to introduce. She's at loggerheads with DEFRA over seasonal agricultural workers. And I think she'll be at loggerheads with Kemi Badenoch and Grant Shapps over general restrictions to visa routes too. So I just think she's obviously secured one limited win, which is the ban on foreign student dependence under PhD level. But beyond that, could you see a scenario where in a few weeks' time or a few months' time, things haven't changed, she hasn't got the policy win she wanted, people on the right of the party are starting to look for a scapegoat. She doesn't want to be that scapegoat, and she's starting to position herself for the next election or after, or even maybe if things go really badly before. I think there is every chance that she could resign.
We've started talking about Boris Johnson already. I wonder if there's ever going to be a month on this podcast that we don't need to talk about Boris Johnson. So he's back in the headlines, which means questions about rule breaking are too. And as with much of what we're discussing today, the role of the civil service is part of the story, and in particular, how officials interact with ministers and whether ministers think that the civil servants are doing the job they need or actively working against them. Some ministers, and indeed some other think tanks, have called for a more politicised civil service with more political appointments. But this week, the IFG has published its position, and the author of that paper, IFG Programme Director Alex Thomas, joins us now. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Emma.
Okay, so before we get into your report, Kath, I want to ask you to summarise the latest twist in the never-ending tale of Boris Johnson.
Yeah, so this is all to do with the COVID inquiry, but it also takes us back to Partygate. As part of the COVID inquiry, pretty much anyone who is anyone in government is going through all their papers, working out where they were or what papers they were looking at, emails they sent, WhatsApps, all sorts of stuff. And to do that, because an inquiry is a massive legal process, they all have lawyers. And these are all lawyers that are paid for by government. They are government, you know, they are effectively doing so on behalf of government because they were all in government positions when they do so. So this is normal that the government are the ones who are effectively the client, or more specifically, the Cabinet Office. So because of that, lawyers have been going through all of Boris Johnson's papers, but particularly his diaries, and discovered that there were perhaps more questions to be asked about what he was doing during COVID lockdown periods, and particularly guess that he had at Chequers, and I think a few more questions about other things that he was doing at Number 10 that the Sue Gray inquiry hadn't investigated. These lawyers, their ultimate client was the Cabinet Office, raised it with the Cabinet Office. The Cabinet Office turned to the guidance, which says that if somebody is accused of rule breaking, you've got to tell the police. Shock, horror. So they referred the matter to the police without, as we understand it, telling any ministers about this. This was not a political move. This was just a process between the lawyers and the Cabinet Office. But obviously that led to the revelation coming out in the papers and a whole host of other consequences.
Indeed, and there's also been now this fight over what exactly is the inquiry allowed to see and what are they not allowed to see.
Yeah, so that seems to be a separate story that's arisen, but the two have obviously mashed together. We don't really know why or what they're saying, but some of Boris Johnson's WhatsApps, I think in particular, some of his other entries in his diary have been redacted or were redacted when they were sent over to the inquiry. Arguably, from the Cabinet Office's point of view, because they were not relevant to the inquiry, but were just politically embarrassing, as we've heard it. But the inquiry set up under the Public Inquiries Act has the powers to insist on it. And if not, you can send people to jail. So they used a Section 21 order? You're the expert, Emma.
That's right, Section 21.
And so insisted that they get the full unredacted versions across. But Boris Johnson, back to him, was not happy that this was then revealed in the way that it then came out. And so he wrote a stern letter to Baroness Hallett, saying, I don't want you to reveal this. I've got no lawyers now because I've sacked my lawyers because they were telling people that I had committed, you know, potentially committed crimes. So I've got no way of sort of dealing with this. Can you delay putting it out there? If you can't delay it, can you put out this letter that sternly says that I shouldn't? I mean, it seems farcical, but this is all very serious stuff. You know, the COVID inquiry does need to do its work. And similarly, there's been lots written about Partygate, but it matters to an awful lot of people that the government isn't seen to be above the law. And obviously, the first thing that we're going through with the COVID inquiry is going to be the public hearings, is going to be an opportunity, particularly for people who've been bereaved by this, who've been affected by it, to talk about it. So it is very serious stuff. It's just this accumulation of stories at the same time is quite amazing.
And indeed, it's not over yet. I mean, as far as we know, the Cabinet Office and its lawyers are still refusing to comply. They've got now 14 days to decide whether to challenge it at judicial review, or indeed for Baroness Hallett herself to challenge their intransigence. I mean, Harry, where do you see this ending? Do you think there's a real prospect of Johnson and his lawyers taking, or indeed Cabinet Office taking the COVID inquiry to court, or vice versa?
I think it's possible that the inquiry could take the government, they could judicially review their decision. I don't think it will happen the other way around. I think what's more likely is that the Cabinet Office has tried it on here because probably, I do understand the reasons for wanting to redact certain entries, because if they, you know, they'll be making a judgment which is different to the inquiries about what they think is relevant and the need to protect certain very sensitive parts of government. I mean, some of these messages are messages between Boris Johnson, a very, very senior advisor in Number 10, who also just happens to be a close friend personally. So you can imagine the kind of entries that might be in those WhatsApps. So I can see why there is a bit of back and forth. But ultimately, I think the Cabinet Office will succumb to the pressure from the inquiry and hand them over.
What do you make of it, Alex? Do you think the inquiry is overreaching?
I think there'd almost actually be some public value in testing this a bit and understanding exactly what the limits are. So I don't think we should see it necessarily as a failure if it does end up being judicially reviewed or in court, because a bit of clarity around this would help. I suppose I'm torn, because I think, you know, there will, unless everything is given to the inquiry, there'll always be conspiracy theories. I mean, we saw with the Chilcot process that that didn't satisfy a lot of those who wanted a different outcome, both from the inquiry and for Tony Blair and others involved in that decision. So there is a value to sort of complete transparency. Equally, and perhaps this, as I sometimes say, is the ex-civil servant in me, I feel a little bit queasy about an inquiry that can contain within its own scope the scope of other things that were going on at the time that might have distracted ministers from it, if you see. So one of the arguments that Baroness Hallett seems to be making is, I have almost unlimited reach to look at documents, texts, communications in government, because it's relevant to COVID if a minister was distracted by something else or spent more of their time on something else. I follow that logic, but I do feel a little bit of kind of scope creep.
For me, part of the issue is that with an inquiry, stuff comes out so soon. But there is also a mentality for this. If you are in government, everything that you do that relates to government is public information. It is part of the Public Records Act. Doesn't matter whether it's WhatsApps, it doesn't matter whether it was jokes or gifts that you were sending or whatever. Ultimately, the public have a right to know how decisions were made and what their politicians were up to. And if you don't like that, you can't be in government. Now, obviously, there is a difference between that and then it comes out very soon after you were in government. That's why we have a 20-year waiting period on, you know, public records normally coming out. But I don't like the idea that stuff shouldn't end up in the public domain at all. And I fear that that is slightly creeping in, especially when it comes to some of the more informal ways in which senior policymakers communicate with each other at the moment. We've seen that with the Hancock WhatsApps and all the rest of it. You know, if you don't like the fact that your WhatsApps are getting out, then maybe communicate in more serious ways with each other. But yeah, I can understand, you know, the point about, but it's so soon after, and is it, you know, relevant to the public inquiry, and how will the information get out there, and will it be understood in the context in which it actually happened?
There was one quick point, super geeky point, but hey, it's the IFG podcast, is that this has shown up some quite weird consequences of the way that lawyers support former ministers or current mm-hmm. ministers in inquiries. It is quite odd that, in a way, it doesn't matter who's paying for the lawyers, put that to one side. You can pay for a lawyer and then and the client can be different. But it is a little bit odd that the Cabinet Office is the client in this case to lawyers who are advising Boris Johnson. I don't for a moment think that Boris Johnson sacking his lawyers and hiring other lawyers will make any difference at all, because lawyers have the same professional duties and, you know, he's going to be disappointed. It might come up the process a bit, but he's not going to get the outcome that he wants there, I don't think.
But surely if Boris Johnson, he's making lots of money for speeches, could use his own money, get his own lawyer. The point is, if you want the Cabinet Office to pay for it, I likened it to a colleague earlier to the succession where Greg was in a really difficult position. His granddad wanted to get him a lawyer. He tried that for a bit, and then Waystar were offering him a lawyer, but that meant being part of the Waystar Royco kind of team and all the rest of it. I think there is a choice there, but obviously lawyers cost money.
Yeah,
so
succession isn't the model that I'd...
No. I'm just trying to explain it to people, yeah. You know, if you watch Succession. But no, I agree, that's probably not the model you want to go for.
It is slightly ironic, isn't it, that Boris Johnson has come a cropper. Also, it looks like he might come a cropper because of this arrangement, as you say, Alex, this unique arrangement whereby the Cabinet Office is the client. And I think you've got a point, Kath, here. I think the provision has always existed that former ministers can get legal representation paid for by the taxpayer. But Boris Johnson has earned £5 million in outside earnings since he left the office of Prime Minister. So he could have easily afforded his own lawyers. And he still is trying to get the Cabinet Office to agree to fund a new set of lawyers that he's bringing in. But as Alex says, if they find wrongdoing, they'll still have the same principal requirement to disclose that information. So, and it's also, the thing I find bizarre about this story is he's got one set of lawyers, which are his private lawyers that he's instructed, who are saying, apparently, according to his spokesperson, that there's nothing to see here. But then you've got the others who were going through the diary entries. And I think actually there's an important point. These diary entries, the reason it's actually only a specific number that they were able to go through. It wasn't, they didn't have access to the entire thing because the inquiry was asking for specific dates. But they were going through them, and then they obviously felt they needed to refer them. So that again, is another bizarre, fascinating dynamic to all of this.
Well, it's 14 days until one or the other side can JR this decision. So we'll talk about it again, I'm sure, in weeks to come. I'm going to try and bring this back to civil service impartiality now, Alex. So yes or no, for or against?
Yes, for civil service impartiality. It will stagger everybody to learn. No, do believe in civil service impartiality. And it does play into all of these discussions. I mean, there's this awful kind of phrase about the blob that is kind of ministerial civil service relationships that lots of people are talking about at the moment. But to kind of cut back to the principle thing, I think, and we've said this week, that civil service impartiality is important. There have been some debates recently about whether the civil service, there should be more political appointments in the civil service, and it's a fair debate to have. But the basic principle of recruitment on merit, permanent civil service with permanent expertise that sits in the heart of government and without needing to, you know, shift hundreds or possibly thousands of jobs when a government changes, is really important. It's really important for the fact that ministers receive honest advice from their officials. It's important for kind of the continuity of government and the continuity of policy over time. There's quite a lot of evidence to suggest that it's important in protecting against corruption, and that governments with more political appointments tend to be more corrupt. And so public officials hired on merit and not owing their allegiance to politicians is useful from that respect. Two sort of caveats to it, though. One is that it is not at all clear that the civil service is demonstrating some of those benefits of impartiality, particularly the permanence and the long-term expertise. Civil service churn is pretty high. You know, it's matching ministerial churn in some respects. And I also think there's something, I was listening to the earlier conversation with Harry, something really important going on about civil service leaks. Part of the deal between civil servants and ministers is that ministers don't slag off civil servants while that's breaking down, but also that civil servants then keep things confidential. I completely agree with what Harry said earlier, that it's not as simple as saying that civil servants are phoning him up and saying, here's a juicy story for you, please just write it up for me now. But I do think without being able to attribute where any particular story has come from, there is a bit of a cultural shift in the civil service that things are leaking out, sometimes legitimately, arguably over some of the Afghanistan evacuation stuff or the Dominic Raab bullying allegations, where there's nowhere else to turn. But quite often that kind of trust is really breaking down. And I think there's, you know, reinforcing civil service impartiality is an opportunity to also reinforce the obligations on civil servants for working in government.
And let's just pick up on that point on leaks, Harry, because I know you said earlier, you know, it's for the birds, the idea that civil servants are kind of constantly ringing you up, actively trying to undermine government ministers and their policies. But, you know, how far is this a problem that's emerging?
I genuinely, this is my honest view, I'm not going to endear me to people in the government right now on the political side, but I genuinely think it's massively overblown. And what I would say, Alex, is that to give you some reassurance, I actually look at this in another way, actually almost from the opposite side. I think over the last couple of years, we have seen a situation where senior management level civil servants have become too scared and too close to the government of the day. So I think, for example, there are serious questions about the current cabinet secretary and his proximity to the Prime Minister and his office. We've seen that through the WhatsApp leaks, the lockdown files. We've seen multiple issues with cabinet ministers. For example, when Dominic Raab was forced to resign, he wrote an op-ed for The Telegraph in which he claimed he was being tipped off by he didn't refer to which cabinet secretary, but a cabinet secretary and somebody in the Propriety and Ethics Office about informal complaints. And I just think that there is actually, if there is leaking going on from civil servants, I wouldn't describe it as leaking. I think that often what happens is very good journalists get tips and then they call up people, and some people will be honest, some people won't. What I think is happening is that a lot of civil servants at kind of the lower, medium level, but even at the higher levels, they feel that the safeguards to protect them and to ensure that they're able to do their job within the confines of the civil service code, but, you know, just within the normal strictures of government, they don't feel that those safeguards exist anymore. So Dominic Raab is alleged to have behaved badly towards civil servants his entire cabinet career, from the moment he was the Brexit secretary onwards through to when, you know, he eventually had to step down as justice secretary. And there seem to have been repeated instances where these things were being flagged to senior civil servants, but not enough was being done to put a stop to it. So if you have a scenario where civil servants feel they have no other outlet but the media, and let's be honest, the media has proven an incredibly effective medium through which to get a result, then I think that's understandable that people would go there. The other thing I would say is, we talked about the ministerial code earlier and, you know, whether it should always lead to resignation, but I can't think of a time in recent years where a investigation into whether a minister has breached the code has started before the media has found out about it. Every single breach and investigation subsequently ordered came after journalists exposed a story. And that suggests to me that there isn't enough challenge in the government, because otherwise these things would be getting flagged first and then the media would find out about them. But that never happens. I would just say that as a slight counter.
It's a really, really fair point. And I mean, thank you for sharing such a sort of reflective and thoughtful variant on that, because I think it is helpful to explore these sorts of things. I mean, 2 points. On the ministerial code point, take your point, although there are things that where the civil service does push back on that never need to be exposed by the media, if I can put it that way. But I do, you know, basically agree with you. On the civil service leaks point, I think part of it, and I mentioned the Raab and Afghanistan stories as points where I think it was legitimate to expose them, it's that it is very, very unclear what the line is on whistleblowing, what the line is on how to escalate some of these things, and what to do when there is a failure of process there. So I don't, in criticising civil servants for potentially leaking, I don't ascribe any sort of moral, you know, judgment on that. It's that there's a bit of the system feels like it's broken here, and odd things are kind of happening, and pressures are arising in all sorts of different ways that I do think need to be fixed. So with Raab, for example, a better complaint system about ministerial behaviour for Afghanistan, things being taken more seriously internally, and then, you know, other issues as they arise.
Okay, let's end the pod where we began, talking about Suella Braverman and specifically the Home Office, because as government departments go, this is one that definitely deserves the prefix troubled. So what's the problem? How deep does it run, and how can it be fixed? Well, a new IFG paper out today has a pretty stark judgment, I think, and its co-author, Rhys Klein, joins us now. Hi, Rhys.
Hi, Emma.
So tell us what the problem is with the Home Office.
Well, we started with the problem of trying to figure out why the Home Office lurches from crisis to crisis to the extent that it does. And really, we're trying to understand where that problem comes from on sort of three planes, right? So part of it is clearly the politically controversial policy areas that the department is charged with leading: asylum, immigration, policing, the border. These have for a long time created crises for the ministers. But part of it also is about the culture of the department and the way the department works. And to get into that, we revisit Wendy Williams's review into the department in the aftermath of the Windrush scandal, because she captures at great length and in great detail some of those cultural failings, whether it's a failure to be open to scrutiny, to take a compassionate approach to delivery, to work effectively with other parts of government, and to maintain a high workforce morale. So we sort of dig into those to understand to what extent those are still active problems undermining the department today. Hint, yes, they are. And to what extent the department has made progress in the preceding years.
And, you know, you rightly paint a picture of this being an ongoing problem that has plagued many Home Secretaries, lots of different administrations. I mean, how much is Braverman to blame for any of what is wrong in today's Home Office?
Yeah, well, I think that's a fair starting point you made there, which is these are really long-term problems. We opened the report with a quote from Herbert Morrison, the Home Secretary in the 1940s, who describes the department's corridors as being paved with dynamite, ready to blow up Home Secretaries at any moment. You know? So it's long been crisis prone, but what I think is fair to say is that culture change of the order required needs political leadership and commitment. And Priti Patel, as Home Secretary, gave the green light to the Comprehensive Improvement Plan, accepted all of the Williams recommendations. We argue that Suella Braverman has not shown the same level of commitment. And earlier this year, we saw that with the reports that she was watering down commitments to several of the pledges in that improvement plan. So, you know, it is on Braverman today to try to fix problems, even if they've been around for a long time.
And Harry, on the Home Office, I mean, is a department that, as Risa said, has corridors paved with dynamite fit for purpose, or should we be looking to change it somehow?
I think it certainly has massive problems. One of the problems they have is that, and you identify this, is the lack of kind of cooperation between the Home Office with other departments. We're seeing that with their position on immigration. If you've got any friends at DLUHC and or the Home Office, and you ask how the two departments get on, because they work quite closely on a number of things, such as rehousing asylum seekers, they are constantly clashing. There is a big institutional clash between those two departments. And then you also make a good point about the Ministry of Justice and, you know, the fact that a lot of what the work the Ministry of Justice is doing seems to be quite relevant to the Home Office, but they're almost kind of siloed. So I think they're interesting points. To go back to your point, Emma, about whether it's failing, I think in some respects, yes. And in regards to Windrush, what I thought was interesting is you talked about the fact that they haven't accepted some of the recommendations. I actually think it goes a bit further than that, because back in January, I reported this in the Sunday Times, and it didn't really get much follow-up. But they're not only not adopting some of the recommendations, they're actually re-implementing hostile environment policies. So what they announced in January was that they were going to resume bank data sharing. That was closed down in 2018 when Sajid Javid was Home Secretary, because what was happening was people who were rightly legally living in Britain, they were being identified as unlawfully living here, and then their bank accounts were being shut down. So they were facing deportation and they couldn't access their money. But that's now being resumed. And then on top of that, Robert Jenrick, the immigration minister, has kind of convened a task force to look at data sharing between the NHS and the Home Office, accommodation providers, and different parts of the economy, like the gig workforce. And I think one of the things that I imagine that civil rights campaigners are very worried about is the data sharing, if this does happen, with the NHS. And the intention behind that is basically that they think that immigrants who go to the NHS will be more candid about their immigration status. But what you're effectively asking doctors and nurses to do is dob people in to the Home Office. And I think that could have serious implications. If someone's ill, would they not go to hospital as a result of it? So, sorry, that's a very long-winded way of saying I think there are some quite serious problems here.
I think that's absolutely right. And just to add one point, as well as the recent policy changes and the pledges that were explicitly dropped earlier in the year, there are also reforms that the department committed to, which are sort of stuck in a kind of limbo. Mm. So, for example, it's made particularly slow progress simplifying immigration legislation, as it committed to do in 2020. So there's a raft of quite sort of murky pledges that we don't quite know the status of.
One of the suggestions that always comes up when we're talking about what's wrong with the Home Office is, should it be broken up? You know, does it just have too broad a range of kind of competing responsibilities? Tim, machinery of government change is one of your specialist subjects. How daunting would changing the Home Office in some way be?
The point we always make on rearranging departments is you've got to know what you are trying to achieve with the new organisations. It is not just about changing the plaques on doors and ministerial titles and email addresses. It is about what is it that I want the government to be doing differently as a result of these new organisations coming into existence. I think the thing with the Home Office is, it's easy to think of it, because it, you know, has this troubled history and people have been talking about it for a long time, as this kind of bastion of the British state. But actually, the Home Office has been moved around quite a lot in the last few decades. So the Ministry of Justice only came into being under the new Labour government. Previous to that, the Home Office was in charge of prisons, for example. It also hasn't always had the same role that it has currently on immigration. Part of what David Blunkett did when he was Home Secretary was he brought some of the work visa stuff that he had as in the Education and Employment Department into the Home Office. So the idea that it's always been thus and therefore can't change, I think, is not right. At the same time, rearranging any department is massively disruptive. And I think, realistically, the problems that people have identified around, you know, the policy decisions that create real-world problems, rearranging the department wouldn't change that. And actually, the question on culture and the sort of kind of fortress mentality of the Home Office, yes, perhaps breaking it up might help that. But also, we know that these changes are hugely disruptive to the people going through them, both ministers and officials. And you might risk people sort of doubling down even further and rejecting any criticism. So I think it's definitely not a sort of get out of jail free card for the problems in Marsham Street.
So, Rhys, what do we say in the report? How do you go about fixing the problems of the Home Office?
We sort of take a staged approach. So, as I mentioned earlier, some of this is cultural. And what we call for right away is that the Home Secretary and Permanent Secretary should recommit to those post-Windrush changes and follow it up with a new departmental improvement plan to explain how they will build on the progress that they have made already. And I totally agree with Tim's points on machinery of government changes. Our argument in the report is that prior to becoming Prime Minister last summer, Rishi Sunak said he would look into more fundamental reform of the Home Office to try to flesh out, I suppose, whether there's any meat on the bones of these perennial questions that follow the Home Office around, whether it should be split up with borders and crime, and whether the relationship with MOJ is working. And essentially, that's what we argue, is that the Prime Minister shouldn't duck those more difficult questions, not least because actually getting to grips of them can help avoid sort of stumbling into those machinery of government changes that aren't very well thought out in the first place.
Okay, so I think that's it for us today. Thanks, Rhys. Thanks for listening at home. And thank you to Kath Haddon, Alex Thomas, Tim Durrant, Rhys Klein, and especially to you, Harry. Remember, you can find all our podcasts at iTunes, Spotify, and on all major platforms. And be sure to subscribe and give us a good review. While you're here, subscribe to our sister channel, IFG Events 2. All our best events are now landing in your podcast feeds, including an event with IFG this week on, of course, civil service impartiality with Gus O'Donnell, Aisha Hazarika, Rachel Wolfe and George Eustace. They all joined us for a fantastic conversation. Our new papers, both on civil service impartiality and the Home Office, are available to read on our website, along with a whole load of new commentary on things like Labour's NHS plan, Sunak's apologetic industrial strategy, and the latest immigration stats. Parliament has headed off for recess and MPs are back in their constituencies, so it should, in theory, be quieter in Westminster next week, but I doubt it will be. Have a good weekend, everyone, and see you next week.